Live to see it, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-author, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I'm doing great on our amazing Wednesday here. So
I was just about to say it's an amazing Wednesday, and we've got an amazing show that we're going to kind of back into, if that's okay. Because when you call a show Coffee, Cheese, and VR Chickens, it's almost required that you back into that, don't you think? I mean, how do you don't go straight into the actually, we are going straight into the cheese, coffee, but we're saving the VR chickens for last, okay?
So you know, I'm wondering if I should completely disown the title and say this is all on Phil, but you know what? It'll probably turn out to be brilliant, and I want to be a part of it. So
do that right now. Let's just say this one's all me, okay? I'm ready. When they hand out the Pulitzer, okay,
yeah,
I get it.
It'll be on Phil, and I'll just be in the audience, you know, doing like the soft clap, you know, the really polite clap.
So they're going, we did a lot better shows than this one. I don't know.
Yeah, we've done better than this. Come on.
Yeah, what's going on? But actually, we never have, because this is the best show ever, because we're going to talk about coffee, cheese, and VR chickens, and we're going to talk about the need for something more, how our brains are wired to make us want things we don't have, or just to drive us to desire that which we have not yet achieved. But before we get there, I just want to talk a little bit about how our brains are wired, because I thought these first two stories were interesting, so we'll just glance off them real quick. The first one, cheese triggers the same part of the brain as hard drugs, study finds. And that's really the whole story right there. You can read the headline, and you essentially know everything you need to know about the story. It turns out that the chemical casein is in cheese, and you know what it does is it triggers your brain's opioid receptors, and those are linked to addiction. So basically, if you like cheese, and boy, I like cheese. I don't know about you, but if you like cheese, your desire for cheese is being triggered pretty much the same way a heroin addict's desire for heroin is being triggered. Now, I read that and I go, well, is that really any different from, you know, if I like milk duds, you know, or if I like hot dogs or whatever, you know, a person.
You know, what if you're a risk junkie or something? You like driving fast or something. I mean, anything that you get enjoyment out of, you know, it's going to trigger some sort of dopamine response or something in your brain, right?
So you would think. Although I guess the trick is they don't all have casein in them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And casein is there, and it's acting on your brain in the same way.
I suspect it's not the kind of hard hitting high that heroin is, and therefore not as bad for you either, right?
I don't know. I've had some pretty good cheese, but yeah.
or you're just sitting back in a stunned state of catatonic after eating that cheese. It was so good.
You don't see people destroying their lives over cheese the way they do with heroin.
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna say
quite the downside that you'd see with hard drugs.
You're probably onto something there. Probably not as tight a grip. Now let's talk about one that is absolutely as strong an addiction, and that is this story, you actually would die without your coffee, research says. I enjoyed this story so much, and somebody, when I posted it on Facebook, somebody left the comment. They said, is this for real or a joke? And I've read the article a couple times, and I haven't followed all the links within it, and I'm still not 100% sure. Actually, I'm pretty sure the research is all real that's being cited, that the attitude with which it's being presented is more fun and tongue-in-cheek.
The headline might be a bit of an exaggeration, huh?
Yes, because you're actually going to die either way, okay?
Given enough time, right?
Yes, if you drink your coffee, if you don't drink your coffee. But drinking 3 to 5 cups of coffee per day gives you a longer life, making you 15% less likely to die early, lowering your risk of dying from a heart attack or a stroke by 21%, and slashing your risk for type 2 diabetes by 12%. Now, assuming that those numbers are correct, that is a great testimony for coffee, right? I mean, that you read that and you go, well, I guess the fact that I really don't function well without this is kind of justified here by these statistics.
It doesn't say
make it 6 to 10 cups to get twice the benefit. So, you know, don't go.
There's a point at which there's diminishing returns, I'm sure. But I've heard that part of what's good about coffee, besides the fact that caffeine gets you moving in the morning, is a lot of antioxidants. There's some good stuff with coffee. There's lots of complex good things happening when you drink a cup of coffee. So, you know, I never miss my cup or two in the morning. So, you know, kind of gets things going, right?
So I think we're very similar in these respects, Steve. We're both wired to eat cheese. We're both wired to drink coffee.
Yeah.
And now here's the fundamental wiring we share with all our listeners and with everyone. This story, neuroscience confirms that to be truly happy, you will always need something more. And this is very, very interesting because when you get into this, I think what you're reading here is kind of the neurological explanation for the law of accelerating returns as it's played out in human behavior. Ray Kurzweil's idea of the law of accelerating returns, or as I've called it, the human imperative. This idea that we're always, always, always trying to make things a little better. That it seems that we're constantly driven to take the next step, to get to the next plateau, to achieve one more feather in our cap, right? Or have one more good thing happen.
I'm reminded of an old movie. It's Rock Hudson and I believe it was Tony Randall. Tony Randall's character is this multimillionaire, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Rock Hudson's character is now a multimillionaire himself, but he started out at the bottom and achieved his money, right?
Tony Randall inherited the money, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
This and is so, Pillow Talk with Doris Day.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the quote was this. He says, you know, you came up from the bottom and you earned all your money, and that's awesome. And I was born a millionaire, and I'm still a millionaire. I can't get ahead. I think there's something to that. I think that, some of the most miserable people you'll ever meet are those who just they have everything, and I think hope has a big part of your happiness. If you have hope to improve your situation and you're working at it, and you have a reason to get up in the morning and do whatever it is that you're doing to improve whatever, right? I think it's not so much a finish line and a place to, you know, it's a process, right? You know, being happy. I don't think that you ever really arrive. You just, you know, keep
well,
working.
In fact, the process seems to be one of the things that keeps us going. And it seems to be one of our deepest drives. This neuroscientist, I'm going to say his name is Jock Panskep, and I apologize if that's way far off base, but it looks like Jock Panskep to me. He says we have 7 core instincts that are hardwired into the human brain, not counting cheese and coffee, okay? He says anger, fear, panic/grief, maternal care, pleasure/lust, play, and seeking. So if you look at what the brain is programming us to do, right, these programs it's carrying out to make us behave in certain ways, those are it. Everything we do is running one of those programs. And he says, by far, seeking is the most important. It's the one that we have in common with all mammals. So when I said in common with all our listeners and then with all people, I didn't go far enough. Okay, it's actually something that is within our, what do you call that, kingdom? Of living things. We're looking all the time. We're being rewarded for exploring our surroundings, and we're seeking new information for survival. It's embedded in who we are. We're born doing this in the same way we're born doing all those, you know, all those other things, being afraid, being angry, seeking pleasure, taking care of young ones, right? These basic hardwired behaviors. And of them all, this is the one, once again, dopamine is being released when we engage in this behavior and make something happen. So it probably accounts for an awful lot of just normal day-to-day stuff, doing your job, taking care of your family, doing your chores around the house, but it also accounts for all of learning, right? All of scientific research, all of people trying to create new things, make art, right? Make big projects happen. Big projects within government, for example, right? Any of those would be good examples of this seeking behavior, this stepping out into the world, looking for something, trying to make something happen, and getting a reward for it. It's an innate human desire, and it means that we can never truly feel that every desire and wish has been met.
Right.
That's the way it's
There's
worked.
No finish line.
There is no finish line, because ultimately when we think that we're working on a particular goal, we are. You know, we're working to achieve some good thing, but what we're really working on is feeding this beast inside of us. And once you feed it, it's hungry once again. So no excuse for Tony Randall. He should have been working on being a billionaire or
Another movie quote. Another movie quote.
Oh, please.
Forrest Gump.
Keep it real.
Right? In Forrest Gump, he gets the news that he doesn't need to worry about money anymore. And his comment was, good, one less thing.
That's right. I love that.
And so, you know, here, I mean, even if you have all the money in the world, you still have other ways that you would, other things to be concerned with, other goals to meet, right?
Exactly.
So.
And I believe, I honestly believe that that will be pretty much the attitude of this planet once we move to true post-scarcity.
Right.
And be like, okay, well,
one less thing to worry about. But, yeah. Hey, you know, I've got other things I want to strive for.
But let me tell you about my personal life, right? It's a mess. And then you get the whole thing, right? So there it is. We are trying to make things happen. We are seeking to accomplish these ends. And I thought, well, let me find some good examples. And, of course, everything we talk about on this program relates to the human imperative, relates to the law of accelerating returns as it's played out in human behavior. So it's not hard to come up with examples of this. And I thought, well, I'll just do some really big, obvious, juicy ones from a world transformed standpoint. And the first one here is not news, even on this show, because we've been talking about this quite a bit. But the story is, it's happening. Scientists can now reverse DNA aging in mice. And so this is the same story that we've been talking about. The NAD plus research in mice, which is showing this astounding ability to reverse cell damage. As we talked about, I think it was last week, it's not just aging, although aging is probably the best example of damaging cells that we have on a consistent basis, but it would also reverse damage done by radiation or brought about through other causes. But if you look at aging in a life form, in a mouse or a human or what have you, as primarily being a matter of damage to the cell, this is fixing aging. That's about as big a breakthrough as you can have. And so I don't mind that we keep bringing it up and talking about it, because this is one of the big goals.
Right? You know, imagine, you could have an ongoing treatment for this on your way to Mars, right? And, and reverse the cell damage that's ongoing, rather than having to come up with I don't know some sort of magnetic shielding or something for the ship. It might be easier to fix our cells in route. I don't know.
That is the other application of this that keeps getting mentioned. And I got to say, well, even if I don't go to Mars, I am anticipating a good deal of cell damage over the next few years. So
it happens. Stick around long enough, and you'll have some damage to reverse.
One of the things that is quite intriguing about this, if you read this story, is the plan is to trial a similar drug in humans before the end of this year. So hopefully by this time next year, we'll have some preliminary results, or maybe by 2 years from now, preliminary results of human trials with this. Because one of the big cautions, one of the big red flags on this story is the last word in the headline there, right? Scientists can now reverse DNA aging. Sounds great until you get to in mice. Okay.
Well, the thing is, it's a proof of concept. And mice are little mammals. They have a lot in common with us, but, there's a lot different. And
let's just talk about the cheese thing just for a moment, if we could, okay? I don't want to draw too many parallels.
I bet you cheese really hits little mice brains hard. You know, I'm just saying.
Okay, it had to be mentioned. But they're like us. They engage in seeking behavior. They live normal mammal lifespans, and through this process, damage in their cells is reversed. Now, what's pointed out, and I think what you have to be aware of, is that mice are not little humans. And so sometimes things work in mice that don't work in humans. Some things work for us that don't work for them. You can't always be 100% sure. One thing that comes to mind is calorie restriction, which has been shown to have these dramatic effects in preventing aging among mice. It has been hard to reproduce those results for humans, right?
Primarily because it's hard. I mean, it's a hard thing to do.
Well, it's a hard thing to do, but it's also, and it's hard, and it takes a long time to establish that in a human lifespan as opposed to a mouse lifespan. The great thing about mice is they're not little humans, but they do have short little lifespans that, you know, if you expand it, you know in a fairly short period of time that you've done that. If you expand a human lifespan, it takes years, right, to actually know that you've done that. So caution, it is in mice, but the good news is there's no reason to think that isn't a more or less universal mammal thing, what NAD plus does in the cell. So there's no reason to think that there won't be some positive results from these human trials. We shall see. And if it works, the seeking behavior is going to lead a lot of us seeking to see when can we try some of this stuff, right?
No doubt.
I know that's what I'm going to be doing. And we'll also, if it doesn't work, obviously the seeking behavior will just continue, and we'll keep looking for other ways to fight aging, because we're going to keep working on that one, obviously, until we make some real... Actually, you can expect for the rest of our lives, however long that is, this is going to be a problem that people are going to be working on trying to solve. I guarantee it.
I mean, the first generation of anti-aging we won't arrive with the first drug that shows promise, will we? It's going to be an ongoing thing for a while.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, all right, how about this next one? Chemists are one step closer to manipulating all matter. This is a great piece in Wired, and I liked it because it talks about solving one of the problems that we've talked about the need to solve for as long as we've done this show, for as long as I've been blogging, we've been talking about this. And this is the ability to isolate a molecule, put a molecule in place, move a molecule around. If you can do that, theoretically, you can perform molecular assembly. If you can put one molecule in place, you can put another molecule in place next to it, right? And you can begin constructing things at the molecular level. This is what I'm talking about here is a vast oversimplification of what needs to happen. But basically, that's what we're talking about. And obviously, molecular technology, molecular construction at that level is another way of describing what we call molecular nanotechnology, the ability to create things at the molecular level. So when they say manipulating all matter in the headline, they're not kidding. They're talking about the technology that will enable us eventually to do that. So it sounds like not a huge step in that direction, but that's a really important step. When you can nail down one molecule and say, yes, I'm holding this one in place, I'm not moving it, you know, necessarily, I'm not doing anything with it, but I can hold it in place. That's a huge step in that direction, isn't it?
Imagine all the areas, Phil, of science and technology that will be affected. I mean, it's hard to imagine an area of science and technology that wouldn't be affected. I mean, when it comes to production of drugs, you can lay down molecules exactly as they need to be to make a particular drug that can't be found in nature or anywhere else. It's just, you know, you can manufacture exactly what you need. There's, you know, material science. You know, you make metals that wouldn't exist any other way, or other materials that are, you know, exotic hybrids that just are not possible any other way. Once you can lay down molecules, or lay down atoms exactly the way you want to build the molecules you need, you know, that is powerful. That is powerful.
This technology, we originally referred to it as Nanotechnology is described by K. Eric Drexler in his classic book, Engines of Creation. More recently, Drexler has referred to it as atomically precise manufacturing. That's the technology that we're talking about. And one of the big breakthroughs that has to occur to enable us to get to atomically precise manufacturing is this ability to isolate a molecule. What's very interesting to me about this story in Wired is that you will not find the word nanotechnology in there once. You will not find a reference to Engines of Creation or Radical Abundance, the more recent sequel that Drexler has written, or to Eric Drexler. It's as though this is a problem that's just popped up and someone is trying to solve it. I don't know if the author of the Wired piece actually has no idea that's what he's talking about.
Which is possible, I suppose.
Or if they're deliberately, Nick Stockton is his name, just to get the gender correct, I don't know if he doesn't know about it or if he's deliberately not saying it. And it's interesting either way. If he doesn't know about it, read up, Nick. This is bigger even than you think. And if he's ignoring it specifically, why do you suppose?
Well, there's been such pushback against the ideas that Drexler put out there, you know, way back in the 90s. That you know, it's you know, it's one of those things that it's almost as if it has to be marketed under a new name when these ideas, when you actually start seeing it happening, it's almost as if even though you're seeing it happen just like Eric Drexler said it would, you know, he's still, you know, in common parlance, has still been discredited, at least with the a lot of people have this feeling that he's been discredited. I never bought into that. I always thought his ideas were brilliant, but a lot of people felt that way. So I think it might be just a remarketing of the old ideas now that we're seeing them actually happening.
Yeah, I think it could be that this author is saying, well, this isn't phony. This is real. Therefore, I'm not going to talk about nanotechnology.
Yeah, therefore, we're not going to talk about Drexler because he's phony. Well, no, he's not. I never bought that. You know, I never.
In fact, this goes to the great debate that occurred between K. Eric Drexler and Richard Smalley long time ago. First in Scientific American, and then it was in Chemical Engineering News. They carried out a debate in writing over whether what Drexler now calls atomically precise manufacturing could ever occur. And one of Smalley's critiques of Drexler was, you can't do it because there's no pincers, there's no fat finger, you know, your fingers are too fat. You'll never be able to make a device like, you know, tweezers small enough to pick up a molecule. In the book, Radical Abundance, Drexler says, you know, the fat fingers argument is one of the biggest wastes of time of all time, because I never said that. I never said that we'd have tweezers fine enough to pick up molecules and move them around. And what he has described has been chemical processes and other ways of approaching it that would have the same effect, that would isolate a molecule in place and allow us to move molecules around. And here we see research that's actually delivering on the first step of that, which in the book, Radical Abundance, Drexler talks about that. He says, when we see this happening, it's going to come through chemical research. It's going to come through material science research. They're going to be working on this, and they're going to make this happen. So I see this story as a huge vindication of Eric Drexler, right?
Absolutely.
Down to the not calling it nanotechnology anymore. So since he doesn't,
yeah,
he doesn't
refer to
it.
It's atomically precise manufacturing, for sure. Well,
yeah.
You know, I've always thought of proof of concept for Drexler's ideas is biology. It's, you know, our bodies do things at the molecular level, and there's no fat finger problem there. And it's happening because it's happening chemically, you know.
There you go.
So we know it can happen there, and why can't it happen elsewhere? Well, it's beginning to. And I'm with you. I feel like this is vindication for him.
Yeah, we're still a ways from printing out our own diamondoid brand-new cars in our garages, but it's coming, okay? Once you isolate one molecule in place, you're halfway there, I think, if not halfway there, maybe the first, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles, which has begun with a single step. In any case, it is a huge accomplishment for these folks who have done this, and I look forward to seeing more progress in this regard, and I look forward to reading more folks talking about the fact that maybe we're on our way to manipulating all matter and the impact that that can have. As listeners to this program know, the impact of that is going to be unbelievably huge, touching on all aspects of, as you were saying, Stephen, business, medicine, basically economy, how the world
works. Everything.
Yeah, it touches on everything. It's kind of hard to overestimate it. And in every one of those respects, it opens up new venues for our seeking behavior to find new outcomes to seek. All of which leads us finally.
I would tell you, like in The Graduate, instead of saying plastics, I would tell that young man, I'd say, atomically precise manufacturing.
That's right. I got three words for you.
Exactly.
Those words are virtual reality chickens. Okay,
virtual reality chickens. Not atomically precise manufacturing. Okay. How in the world is this supposed to work? A virtual reality chickens.
Let me make the case for why this belongs in this show. Okay.
All right.
Because I really wanted to mention this in a show, and I found a way to bring it in. We go after the big problems: world hunger, aging, pollution, atomically precise manufacturing. But we're working on a lot of other things too, okay? People, the desire to make the world a better place, as anyone who has read our book, Visions for a World Transformed, knows, takes myriad forms. It takes as many different forms as there are people thinking about it, and as many different forms as the ideas that people come up with for making the world a better place. So we've got this guy, Austin Stewart. He's an assistant professor of design at Iowa State University, and his idea is, let's improve chicken quality of life. We depend on chickens. Most of us eat chickens. Not all of us do, but a lot of us eat chickens. And the truth is that most of the chickens in the world have a very poor quality of life. Okay, they live in, what amounts to factory farms, similar to the feedlot for larger livestock. They don't get to see much of anything. They don't get to do much of anything. Basically, they get fed their entire short life, and then they're slaughtered to be eaten. So he says, we can solve that problem by putting virtual reality goggles on these chickens and giving them a subjective experience very different from what they're experiencing in their day-to-day lives. And he has come up with an idea. He calls it Second Livestock. Get it? And the idea is, let's create a little virtual happy place for chickens to be in before they're killed. Now, I think this is preposterous on almost every level, okay? But his heart's in the right place, okay? I think we'll actually solve the problem of chicken suffering through vat meat.
In vitro cultured meat is the way to go.
There's no animal
that dies at all for that meat.
Right. Or we might have chickens that grow that don't really ever have a brain or a nervous system that you would need to soothe. Right. It would never have had any pain to begin
with. Of
course,
that's spooky looking too.
Is printed vat meat. Yeah. Those are all they've all got a creepy factor to them.
Right.
This one just has picture it and laugh out loud factor, which I kind of like,
Gosh.
I don't begrudge the chickens their happy experience. I don't see how you would scale this. It seems to me it doesn't address the physical pain that they have, which is probably greater than their boredom or, lack of intellectual stimulation. But I do love the idea. I love that somebody is, looking at chicken suffering and thinking, well, here's the solution. Let's put them all into VR.
It's almost as if Tyson Chickens is being run by Willy Wonka,
Exactly, yeah.
To come up with an idea like this is pretty pretty out there. But, hey, yeah, like you say, it's there's a million of crazy ideas, and we try a lot of crazy ideas, and some of them turn out to be not so crazy eventually.
Some of them work out. And all I can say to Austin Stewart is, keep working on it, okay? And if not this idea, maybe your next one. But I hope to see
way to think outside the box.
Absolutely, kudos for thinking outside the box for sure, and hopefully we'll see more from him later. All right, well, that's going to do it for this edition of The World Transformed. We're going to be back on Friday with a brand new show. Brian Wong is going to be with us. We're going to be talking about making space colonization affordable. Talk about the seeking behavior, huh? That's going to be a big one. So, Stephen, great talking with you. It's great being with you all. We look forward to being with you again on the next World Transformed. And until next time, live to see it.